From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, throughout this campaign season, we've been glad to welcome candidates for federal, state, and local offices. When we can, we bring political opponents together, just as we did yesterday when we welcomed Assemblyman Mark Johns and his challenger, Andrew Gilchrist. But sometimes we can't convince a candidate to come on the program. Well, today we have three guests. At 1 p.m., we'll sit down with Nate McMurray, the Democrat challenging incumbent Republican Congressman Chris Collins. Mr. Collins declined to join us today. This hour, we'll divide it in two. Later this hour, we'll be joined by Assemblyman Harry Bronson, who is running for re-election. But first, joining us from WEOS in Geneva, we welcome Democrat Tracy Matrano. She's running for Congress, challenging incumbent Republican Tom Reed in the 23rd District. Mr. Matrano, welcome to Connections. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan. I'm glad to be here.
I want to be clear that we not only invited Congressman Tom Reed, we tried to be flexible in multiple attempts to schedule and to accommodate his calendar, but we were not able to line up an interview with the congressman before this election. In the past, he has been able to join us on multiple occasions, but we did reach out. It was a good faith effort, and that's why you're only hearing this half hour from Tracy Matrano. Tracy, the voter registration advantage for Republicans in your district, the last I checked, was around 25,000 people. I know you think you can overcome that on Tuesday, but how significant is that advantage for your opponent?
Well, it is an advantage, no doubt about that. It's a little closer to 20,000.
Okay.
But the wild card is the plus 90,000 registered unaffiliated voters, and they're the ones who decide elections in the 23rd district.
Well, for many of our listeners, this is a first chance to learn about who you are and why you're running. So why don't you give us a brief description of, you know, where you grew up, how your career eventually brought you to this congressional race?
Oh, sure. I'm delighted to do it on WXXI because I am from the 19th Ward in Rochester. I grew up on the corner of Westfield and Inglewood Drive. My father had a downtown restaurant. Originally, it was called the Silver Pheasant, and then later in the 60s, changed the name to Matrano's. It was on the block between Main and Broad on South Avenue, pretty much where the convention center now sits. I definitely grew up working in that restaurant. I went to St. Augustine's Elementary School and Nazareth Academy High School, but I worked from when I was 13 to 19 at my dad's restaurant, and so I really had a wonderful experience there. I learned a lot about, you know, family commitment, hard work, and I worked behind the bar because, you know, it was a family restaurant, and that meant I got to meet people from all walks of life, and it was probably the best education I ever had. I did go to the University of Rochester and graduated in 1981 with a degree in history and English, went on to Binghamton University, where I earned a doctorate in American history. I taught in Keuka College, University of Buffalo, Ithaca College, and then returned to Ithaca to marry, have a family, start my family. I have two boys, Nico and Sam. And I then went to Cornell Law School. After that, taught family social policy for a few years, but then I pivoted in 2001 to be the director of information technology policy at Cornell. And that is the work I've been doing, internet policy and cybersecurity, for the last 15 years, and a big part of why I decided to jump into the race for Congress.
Well, tell me a little bit more about that. I mean, was there a single reason or a single moment that convinced you? Is there a single issue that convinced you? Or was it a combination of factors?
Democracy, citizenship, politics have been at the center of the work that I've done as an American historian, policy analyst, and in information technology. But the interference in the election of 2016 definitely concerned me. I've been watching this kind of interference going on for a very, very long time. I think this is the first time that it became more of a public awareness. And when the election occurred, I looked to see if there was anyone in Congress with this kind of background, and it turned out there isn't. So I began formulating my thoughts about running pretty much after that and jumped into the race July in 2017.
Now, your opponent has tried to kind of paint you as an academic who has less touch with common people in your district. And I wonder if you feel like you have a pretty good sense of the pulse of your district, which is obviously a kind of a wide-ranging geographic area that has been hit with economic malaise. We'll talk throughout this half hour about your thoughts on that. Do you feel like you've got a pretty good hand on the pulse of the district?
Absolutely. I grew up in Western New York, and I've lived in the Southern Tier in the Finger Lakes my entire life. So in other words, I have experienced more in all of this district than Mr. Reed has, who has only been in Corning. In addition to that, I welcome listeners or anyone interested in this race to watch or listen to the two debates that Mr. Reed and I had this week. And if you want to have a sense of the pulse, I think you'll get it if you watch those debates.
Well, on the subject of Congressman Reed and his record, he did come on this program earlier this year to support the GOP tax bill that passed, and he said it was primarily designed to offer a tax cut to the middle class. And he has said that it has helped your district. It has helped common families, middle class families, families sort of on the economic edge. Do you agree with that?
Well, if you can get anything back, it's going to help. I certainly appreciate that. But I do think that it is oversold. And I think that that description of it overall in the long course of not only today, but tomorrow, is inaccurate. The working and middle class people have a so-called temporary tax relief, but in a few years that disappears. But the 1% have a so-called permanent tax relief. And we've been working with a trickle-down economic theory since the 1980s. What we have learned from it is that people who have a chance to acquire more wealth do not invest it back into economic development. They hoard it. 40% of the wealth in this country now sits in the hands of the 1%. We have such growing income inequality gap. We have rising levels of poverty. The middle class is being crushed. And you can see it in any number of features, such as free and reduced lunch throughout this district. There's at least 40% on average. Some counties are much higher than that. And in fact, even let's take Chautauqua. It has about 57% of the students are on free and reduced lunch. But you know what? 80-some percent are eligible. Like, people aren't even being able to take advantage of it for any number of gaps in communication in the system and so forth. So it is not the rosy picture that Mr. Reed makes out. Let me make a few other points. This plan also eliminates the estate tax. The estate tax is designed in trickle-down economics as a vehicle by which you get the money back into the public. And so it's a double whammy to give the 1% a big handful of money, and then also there's not the vehicle to bring it back. I would have been in favor of bringing down the corporate rate at 35%. It was too high. It also was not very realistic, because with tax lawyers working the numbers, really our corporations pay between 17 and 19% tax on average. So let's be more realistic at 21%. But what I would have done bringing it down is say that at least 50% of it had to go to wages, to hiring new staff, to capital investment, not just to the shareholders.
How do you track that, though? How do you make sure?
Well, you write it into law.
Well, you don't think corporations aren't good at circumventing those kind of rules, do you?
Well, just because there are efforts to circumvent doesn't mean you don't have law.
Okay, fair enough. Now, would you like to go to Congress to vote to either fully rescind that tax plan, those tax cuts, or to rescind parts of them then?
I would like to flip the so-called temporary and permanent relief. I think we should have the relief we have now for working and middle class and make it temporary for the 1%. I think 25% or 20%, some there, that ballpark would be okay for an estate tax. Maybe 45% was too high. But let's remember, Evan, it doesn't click until you're at $5.4 million of the estate. So bear note. And I would put in those conditions, although we've already lost a lot of the money that's gone into the shareholders after that. Let me give you one more statistic.
Sure.
The studies are now coming out that show that the bottom 20% of people who pay taxes are going to take out this year $40 extra. That people who are in the middle class are going to take between $500 and $600 out. And the 1% on average are taking out $69,000. Mr. Reed's number is only believable if you average in all of those numbers, including the $69,000. So I'm sorry, we've been sold a bill of goods. My contention about Mr. Reed is he votes only for his big corporate donors and the very wealthy in this country. He genuinely does not have the interests of working and middle class people at heart.
Just in an effort to fact check for listeners, best I can tell, what Ms. Matrano just said is accurate in terms of the average savings in terms of the tax cut. And when Mr. Reed was on this program earlier this year, I pointed out to him that if you gave 10 people a tax cut and 9 got $1,000 and 1 got $91,000, the average tax savings would be $10,000. But the average, most people only get one. And that is pretty fairly representative of the kind of savings under this tax plan. So
yes, sir.
Okay, so that's fair. But let's look more broadly at your district when it comes to jobs and wages here. I'm wondering two things. What do you think has caused the hollowing out of so many American communities, particularly everything from mid-sized cities all the way to rural communities like there are so many communities across your district? What do you think is the primary driver of what has hollowed out the economy in those communities? And do you think it's realistic to expect a significant job boom in rural areas?
I'll answer your last question first. Okay. Yes, but you have to lay the groundwork. So at the highest level, we have been for the last 25 years at least in a transition globally from an industrial economy to a, call it what you will, information economy. Some people call it a knowledge economy. You know, places like Rochester, Buffalo, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, they have now been moving towards more prosperity because they've done it through medicine. The University of Rochester is the largest employer in Monroe County, and largely it's because of Strong Memorial Hospital and its affiliates. Same thing in Buffalo, UMPC down in Pittsburgh, Cleveland Clinic over in Cleveland, Ohio. So what I'm trying to say is you have to have something that is going to move along with the transition of this global economy. What happened in the Southern Tier, with the exceptions of Corning and Ithaca, are that no one was helping the community lay the groundwork for that transition. Now, that goes all the way back into the 70s, especially after Hurricane Agnes and the devastation that places like Corning and Elmira and Big Flats experienced with the flooding. But really, it's been in the last 10 years and under Mr. Reed's watch, he got in 2010, for the failure to bring a few things for which the federal government is responsible: healthcare, education, and infrastructure. He has done nothing on these three basic areas. If he had, the Southern Tier would probably be in a more propitious place for investment. But let me just be really simple about it. A 21st century company, for example, Corning, which is an advanced manufacturing 21st century company, is not going to come to a place where there's not the internet. There's not the internet in about 50% of the geography of the district. And that's particularly an insult on injury because Corning Incorporated gave $10 million worth of fiber optic cable that when Route 17 was transitioned to Interstate 87, was laid along the interstate highway, but it's lying there largely fallow, unlit, as you would say in the business. He did nothing to do what we did in the 30s for electricity and in the 50s for telephone, to bring this basic utility and make it available to every farm, every school, every home, and all potential businesses. So this is the kind of neglect that warrants his not supporting a district, and I don't believe people are going to support him on November 6th as a result.
My guest is Tracy Matrano, Democrat running for Congress, challenging incumbent Republican Tom Reed in the 23rd District, who declined to join us on the program before the election. We always ask our guests to let our listeners know your website so they can learn more. Tracy, where are you online?
Oh, wonderful. Tracy Matrano for Congress.com and on Facebook, Tracy Matrano for Congress.
Okay. Now, when it comes to money in politics, we try to ask just about everybody who runs for office from all levels who come on this program, who's your biggest donor? Now, most people say it's the people. It's the small donations. It's, it's $5, $10 at a time. And I'll take the point. But who are your biggest donors and would you be beholden to them?
I don't accept corporate PAC money, okay, unlike Mr. Reed, who accepts gobs and gobs and gobs of it. His biggest donors are Big Pharma, the health maintenance organization, insurance companies, banking lobby, the NRA, fossil and gas. Those are his big, big donors. I don't accept corporate PAC money. I'm trying to think. My biggest donor might have been Kirsten Gillibrand, who from her election PAC, which is different than a, for nonprofit corporate PAC, gave us $5,000. I think that's probably the single largest donation I've received. Evan, I received a call yesterday from Vice News, right out of the blue. I had no idea. They said, do you know that your campaign nationally has raised more money from more women than just about anybody else? Brand new news. Our donations, 75% of them, are from the people in the district. It's a grassroots movement. And in the third quarter, we raised almost $1 million. From June 30th until September 30th, we raised that much money, broke all the records. So I'm sorry, I guess I just have to say we really are taking in small, medium, and larger donations. And that is what has made the campaign financing for this race.
Gary writes to us and wants to know, says, progressive minds want to know, will Tracy Matrano vote for Nancy Pelosi as House Speaker or for new leadership?
I really would prefer new leadership. I'm on the record for suggesting that, you know, it's time for Congressman Pelosi to move on.
Okay. When it comes to climate change, in your district and in, you know, certainly parts of New York State, down into Pennsylvania, there have been conversations about fracking. There have been conversations about energy exploration. And certainly Governor Cuomo in New York State at the state level has addressed that. But I am wondering how you view climate change and how urgently you view it. And in other words, are you willing to vote to sort of, the word radical has sort of a connotation I'm not sure is fair, but would you dramatically move our government, our country away from fossil fuels?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm for, and you're right. That term, first of all, means root. It doesn't mean extreme, but it has taken on
that
connotation.
Yeah, there's a connotation.
So
yeah,
let's just
yeah.
take that right out of the whole conversation.
Yeah.
Because, first of all, I would support moving back to the Paris Accords. We have acute need in this district right now as a result of climate change. Let's set aside the argument of how we got here. In Seneca County, I visited homes where the mud was flowing through the first floor, not the basement, through the first floor of the house down into Cayuga Lake for the failure to manage basic civil engineering, but in the light of these so-called 500-year storms that are happening every other year at this point. Over in Schuyler County, there was such a flood of water that was going down the hillside. If people know that area, beautiful area, a lot of the wineries along there. And that water came down in such a rush that it swept cottages right into the lake. Down in Chemung County, which knows a whole lot about flooding, the management of the Chemung River has been taken care of as a result of Hurricane Agnes back in the 70s, but no one is managing the other tributaries and ways in which this water backs up, and it's going over highways, it's going over roads, it's rushing into farmlands, destroying many areas. So we have an acute need for help. By the way, out in the west, Cattaraugus County in the spring had a lot of flooding that needs to be redressed. This is what we need to do. We need to recognize these events are happening. Look at the two hurricanes we've had, Michael and Florence. We need to do proactive work to be sure that we are doing everything we can to plan for these events. And what does that mean? Essentially, you need federal, state, and local alignment to do it. Yes, I am for doing exactly that. With respect to fracking, let me say this. It was a much bigger issue, I think, 5 years or so ago than it is today.
Okay.
Mainly, I think the reason is that people, very understandable, we're desperate for jobs. This could be an opportunity. But in this amount of time, they have seen what has happened to other states, such as our neighbor Pennsylvania, and they're not so into it. The roads get busted up. It's a big boom for about 18 months, and then everyone takes off. People in this district want sustained 21st century good jobs for which they need good education and for which they need to be healthy. That's really what it is all about here in the 23rd District. So that's not the issue that it used to be.
Okay. But just briefly then, are you going to go to Washington and vote to aggressively move us away from fossil fuels?
I would be interested in looking at the Off Fossil Fuels Act. So I think if I'm taking your meaning about aggressive, I'm going to say no. It's not aggressive, but it just makes sense that we need to get on a path where we're going to de-incentivize fossil fuels, we're going to incentivize renewable energies, but we're going to do it reasonably so we do not upset business, we don't upset the economy, we don't upset the things that we rely on every day, like driving around in a car or turning on the lights. So aggressively is not the way I would describe it. Sensibly, rationally, careful implementation of it appropriately in the interest of our economy and the people who live here and public safety. Yeah, let's do it that way.
I got about 5 minutes left with Tracy Matrano, who's running for Congress. And the subject of health care and the cost of health care is not only a big one for voters, but you've written that it personally impacted your family. Tell us how.
Well, my brother's developmentally disabled and has been in state care since 1958. I visited him, you know, with my parents growing up, and the conditions under which he lived were really horrific, kind of stuff that nightmares are made out of. All the books, Willowbrook and so forth, that is something that as a child I witnessed. So it was only after Medicaid came in the mid-60s, and then after that, along with some court cases and other civil rights for disabled people, gained awareness that the conditions for someone like my brother changed. He now lives in Victor in a group home, very appropriate, and he's been there, gosh, I'd have to think, but 25 years or so, and it's very humane, good circumstance. I don't think we want to be going back to the days when people were treated like my brother was treated as a child when he was institutionalized back in 1958. My mother actually died of very unfortunate medical malpractice mistake, and was she broke all the records over at Strong. She was in ICU for about 9 months. She eventually died, and the hospital sent my father the bills. Now, my father was, you know, that story of the greatest generation. He fought in the war. He and his four brothers were like the Italian version of the Sullivan family, Evan, and they all came back. They opened the restaurant. My father worked day and night, and the bills, being in ICU for 9 months, can you imagine what those totals were? And for the hospital just to, you know, send them, would have bankrupted my father many, many, many times over. And here he was a Bronze Star awardee in the war and worked so hard, member of the community and so forth. So in this case, because it was an accident, we were able to ultimately achieve a settlement. But how about people that, you know, for whom just have one bad accident or one very serious illness? Why in the wealthy country that we are in should people be saddled with that kind of medical debt? And, you know, people in the XXI region may not know what most of us do down here is that Mr. Reed's business before he entered politics was medical debt collection. Medical debt is the number one reason why people go into bankruptcy. And so one might want to ask, is there any relationship between his background and his votes in Congress? He has voted against affordable health care every single time it's come before his desk in Congress, somewhere around 77 times since 2010. And this is something, though, beyond the 23rd District. It is for this nation. We have been working with this issue now for almost 50 years. We're holding this country back by not taking the steps that we need to take in order to bring the cost of health care down. At this point, the only way to do it is to put the negotiating power in the hands of the government so they can get the provider costs, get the drug costs down. It's not a perfect solution. I just see it as the most reasonable one. And at this point, we have to do it in order to move on to address the other challenging issues we have in this country.
Okay, does that mean Medicare for all, single payer, some form?
Yes, those are the terms that people use. But I want to emphasize a little bit like the response to fossil fuels. This has to be done in a carefully implemented way so as not to spike taxes, so as not to disrupt people's health care, and so as not to disrupt the economy. Health care is about 15-20% of our entire economy. So it has to be done carefully. It should include hearing, dental, and vision. Which Medicare does not. So it's not a perfect fit, but it is a close enough fit to go ahead and use those terms to describe it. The main point of it is no one is bargaining on the behalf of Americans right now. That's why healthcare costs are so high. And there's no competition in the market. And so when Mr. Reed says repeal and replace, he has nothing to replace it with. Last night we were at Olean High School, and he was asked this point, and he says very vague things. We need to empower patients and doctors. Well, I'm all for empowering patients and doctors, but I don't know what that means in terms of policy, and I don't know what that means in terms of legislation. There is a model that we have that more or less, I think, is appropriate for us to begin to move forward with, but I would do it in a very carefully implemented fashion so as not to spike those taxes. And also, at the end of the line, studies show we really should be saving somewhere upwards of $2 trillion if we do it. Have you ever seen the compensation packages of CEOs? They make hundreds of thousands of dollars a day. Do you know how much money you pay every time you go to a doctor in advertising and administrative costs? 1/4 to 1/3. Get that fluff out. United States paid $3.5 trillion in healthcare costs last year. That is twice the number of the next highest developed country in the world. We're paying too much for healthcare. It's time to get it down. Let's get the money back into the economy, into other sectors, okay, and let's revive our business.
And let me squeeze in one last question, and then we got to go with Tracy Mitrano, because Harry Bronson will join us next year. Darren writes to us and says, I'm originally from Seneca County. Many new businesses are trying to utilize the former Seneca Army Depot for trash projects. Where does the candidate stand? Can you do it in 30 seconds or less, Tracy?
I do not support the incinerator project in Seneca County, and I think we have to have a moratorium on various external entities coming into this district and treating us like a dump. We have low-level radioactive waste in Cattaraugus. We've got Mount Trashmore up in Ontario, and I am supportive of the efforts to keep the incinerator out.
One more time, your website for listeners to learn more about you.
Yes, sir. TracyMitranoForCongress.com. And on Facebook, Tracy Mitrano for Congress. I'm very grateful for the opportunity to speak, especially to XXI, which used to be my buddy all the time when I lived in Rochester.
Well, Tracy, thank you. We want to remind our listeners that Congressman Tom Reed was invited on multiple occasions and tried to be flexible to make it work with scheduling. And, you know, to be fair to all of the candidates, we know they're busy, they're on the road, they're meeting people every day. And we don't feel entitled to interviews, but we do want to provide a wide open calendar. Just couldn't make it work with Congressman Reed before the election, but you now have heard from the Democrat, Tracy Mitrano, in the 23rd District. Thanks for taking the time, Tracy. We appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
All right. And by the way, thanks to WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio, our wonderful colleagues down there for facilitating that interview. Greg Kelly, the entire crew down there, wonderful job, wonderful partners, and hope that you're listening all throughout the Finger Lakes region on 89.5 FM WEOS. Short break, and Assemblyman Harry Bronson next.